Hi, welcome back to Books and Broomsticks. I'm Chaotic Witchot.
And I'm Matt Hatter Plays.
And today we have with us a very special guest, Madam Pamita. Please introduce yourself. Tell us a little bit about you.
Hi, everyone. I'm Madam Pamita. I am a witch. I am an animist. I'm a spiritualist. I'm a tarot reader. I'm a teacher. I'm an author. I'm a candle maker. I do a lot of different things. And I'm a Ukrainian American and also have some Celtic Scottish, Scottish Irish in me as well.
The ultimate can do anything practitioner. And I gotta say, love your books. Every time I pick one up, I'm like, this is the bed.
I was about to say the same for your candles. We carry them at my store at like my job. And I just like bulk ordered a bunch of the hand dipped like beeswax pillars. So there's just like a pile of them in my corner for spell. Cause I'm like, I need to restock my taper candles. Why don't I just order from Madame Pamita? And that's what I love doing.
Thank you so much, you guys. Thank you.
Yeah. Today, I think we're talking about Ukrainian magic. Matt, would you like to get us started with the questions?
Sure. What does Ukrainian magic look like? Like, what's the structure here?
Well, there's a lot. There's a lot. We could just answer this question for the whole entire show, I think. So I'll sort of talk about it from my perspective. When I was growing up, I think this is, I don't think this is everyone's story, but I find more people have this story. The more magical people I share the story with, they go, I had the same thing too. Where we grow up learning magic in the context of another religion. So I grew up Catholic, but I say my first candle magic was lighting a candle in a church and making a wish. That's candle magic.
Oh yeah.
And you know, beyond that, my mother would do things that were normal for us. I thought it was super normal. But then when I got out into the wider world, I'm like, oh, your mother didn't give you a piece of cake to put under your pillow to dream about your future husband? That didn't happen to you? Or, you know, these different little quirky things that we would do. So it's my mom's side that's Ukrainian. And she would tell me stories about my grandmother doing these things. So for example, she'd say, your grandmother used to hold a bowl of water over a person's head and then pour beeswax into it. And it was kind of a fortune telling thing, but a healing thing. And that's all she could tell me because her mother died when she was in her early 20s. So she didn't get a really big download of that, but she observed it. She told this to me. So I was always kind of trying to find more information. And the interesting thing about Ukrainian magic in particular is it's really archaeology that we're doing when we're going into Slavic folk magic and in particular into Ukrainian folk magic. Because think about this, we have a pagan practice that in 988 ACE was then Christianity was put over that. A lot of peasant people, my grandparents were peasants, they didn't know how to read and write, but they had great wisdom and great knowledge. They were still practicing the pagan practices, but they would tack on, you know, Jesus, Mary, and whatever saint they wanted to add onto this pagan practice. So we have these pagan practices, old practices that are first covered by Christianity. That, you know, they tried to stamp out a lot of the pagan practices, as we know, in all cultures all over the world, that dominating religion would try and do that. But then you had something else, which was this 80 plus years of Soviet regime that banned all religion. So in the 20th century, people really lost a lot of those practices, or they were buried super underground. However, there was something that happened. The mothership sent out all of these people we call the diaspora Ukrainians, who went to other countries, my grandparents included, came to the States. And so they were still able to practice those things because in the States, you were able to still sort of practice your religious beliefs, or you were, as long as it was Christian, I guess you could say, but they were practicing these pagan practices. So Ukrainian magic was really buried under all this stuff. And when I went to go research for my book, I was finding little bits and I'm like, I'm sure I can find more. It'll be easy. And it wasn't that easy. I had to really work very, very hard on that book. So I say my book, Baba Yaga's Book of Witchcraft, was a task worthy of Baba Yaga. It was like separating wheat and poppy seeds, or spinning a whole room full of hemp in one day. It really did feel like that. So,
yeah, I mean, I'm very intrigued just by like the bowl of water and the beeswax, because we do a bowl of water and olive oil, because I'm like, you know, I do Italian American practices, and the similarities between folk magics. But I always am so interested in the ways in which folk magic is similar and the ways in which it's very different. Like there's some remains of like ancient Roman religion in Italian folk magic, but it is so syncretized to the point that like it's just very much embedded in Catholicism. Mm-hmm. Like you have to really, really look at it and kind of really pick it apart. And even then, no one's going to identify it as pagan or ancient Roman religion or ancient Greek religion. It's just something that their grandma did. Mm-hmm, this is mm-hmm. how we do it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So picking it apart like that is so hard, because I mean, as soon as the Catholic Church was formed in Italy, it started happening. Like that syncretization started taking hold.
Yeah, it's amazing. That's one of my like fascinations too, is to see the commonalities and the mm-hmm. differences. So for example, in Curanderismo, mm-hmm. which is in Mexico, right? They have something called an egg cleanse, which yeah. they take the egg and they roll the egg over a person's body to do an egg cleanse. Mm-hmm. Well, for Ukrainians, they also have an egg cleanse.
We do too.
Yeah. So I'm like, we don't even know where this came from. It's such either these things spontaneously sprouted because people could sense the magic of an mm-hmm. egg, or it's so old that it was something that came from one origin point and just spread before there was even history.
I'm always curious about it too, because in folk magic, we have these defining kind of tenets. We have like animism, we have like accessibility, we have the folk, their beliefs. So I always think, I'm like, it's crazy, because if it did just come out of nowhere with a bunch of different people, they all recognize the same symbolism in something and all recognized it. Because I know we call our egg cleanse pulizia, and the egg is seen as like a sacrifice, almost, which is another common thing in Italian folk magic, is there's like sacrifices of time, energy, animals, and that's also very present in folk magic as a whole. But you just rub it on the body, and unlike kind of my understanding of like egg cleansing, like brujería, curanderismo, we don't crack it open to see what happens. We literally take the egg and we flush it down the toilet, because we don't want it. It's absorbing the energy. We don't want it in the house. So you take it, you throw it at the crossroads, or you flush it down the toilet and flush it, and that's how you get rid of like sickness. We do it when we have the flu, or like when my partner was getting sick, I rubbed him down with like a holy water egg and put it on him. Then I flushed it down the toilet. He was better the next day. I'm like, nice, eggs.
Yeah. I mean, the crossroads is another great example mm-hmm. of shared lore, shared magical practice. And there's some unique, I think the thing that is interesting mm-hmm. is seeing both the commonalities and seeing the unique practices in yes. those things, right? So if we go back to the eggs, for Ukrainians have a huge spiritual connection to eggs. It's beyond just using them for cleansing, mm-hmm. but also decorating them with a wax resist method, also can be called a batik method mm-hmm. of decorating the eggs. And this goes back, they know, and they have documentation that this goes back before Christianity, and in fact goes back, because they can see the designs on pottery, goes back to even before the birth of Jesus. So the fact that they're Ukrainian Easter eggs is a new syncretization, not something that is like, oh, we're going to celebrate Easter with this. It's like, oh, we already have this spring pagan practice. Mm-hmm. It's easy to just bring it into the Easter celebration, you mm-hmm. know?
Is that those really cute like eggs where all the egg part is gone, but then it's like shaved down?
Oh, oh, egg. Right here.
Egg. I got some right here.
Egg.
Oh, they're so cool. I love them.
Oh, I love that.
So this is on my little altar over here in my office. There's another one.
Beautiful too.
So I try to find like really old designs. This one's really dusty, actually. I should dust my eggs a little bit more. But this practice is about taking the, it is a talisman. Mm-hmm. It's meant to be protective, and it's meant to guard. It has some similarities with the Middle Eastern practice of having a spirit bowl capture a negative spirit. So there's some of that that goes into these eggs, and they're definitely for blessings and for things like that. We also see that in embroidery, and that's like a universal thing that I think we can see in a lot of cultures, is embroidery weaving and design being an element of protection that you wear. We look at that, you can find it in any culture, wherever you go. There's elements in the clothing design that are there. If you look and you know how to read the code, or you know how to read it. And it's amazing to see this and like go like, oh, I look at that indigenous thing, indigenous American thing. And I'm like, oh, that's like corresponding in some way to what old Ukrainian pagan practices are. Or I look at something that's going on, you know, in Mexican folk culture. These are the things that are around me in the States, of course, and I can see those correspondences, which are so beautiful. I love it.
That's actually a great lead-in to a different part of the shiny outline that once again we have to stick by, otherwise we will get lost forever. What does it look like now that you're a little older? Maybe you've been able to travel to the motherland, so to say. What does Ukrainian magic look like here in the America as a American Ukrainian versus, you know,
someone who stayed? From,
yeah.
Someone who stayed. Well, there's an interesting, unique, there's a very unique situation. Because of that, we were talking before about the layers of how these practices were covered up by, you know, Christianity and then by Soviet Union. I think because the Soviet Union times where they outlawed all these things, they destroyed, they destroyed culture. We can see it happening now with happening with Russia and Ukraine. It's really, really about colonization. They're trying to wipe out Ukrainian language. They spent 80 years trying to wipe out the language, assimilating what and taking what they wanted and then saying this is Russian and it's not Russian, it's Ukrainian and so on. Great example of that, going back to food, you know, food. Borscht is that beet soup. It's Ukrainian soup, but Russians are like, no, it's Russian soup. And so people think it's Russian. It's not Russian.
Oh,
it's
Ukrainian. Yeah, you ask like 90% of Americans, we would have told you that that's some sort of Russian dish. So
exactly.
Thank you for correcting even me. I had no idea.
I'm going to say this as a Ukrainian person, you know, a person of Ukrainian descent, I had things revealed to me. I'm like, what? But if you're colonized, right, you don't realize it until you have an awakening or someone educates you and informs you, right? So, you can feel the effects of it, certainly, but you're not gonna really see it until someone says, hey, wait a minute, and then you're like awakened, right? Mm-hmm. So if we look at the situation, if we look at I think every colonized practice or every has a different story and a different path that has and a different experience. We can't compare or say one's better or worse, or that's not what I'm doing or saying anything like that.
Absolutely.
But what is interesting is that because there was 80 years of complete suppression of religion and complete wiping out of the cultural practices, when people went to the new world, let's say, or they left Ukraine, they were able to have continuity of these practices. And after the fall of the Soviet Union, Ukrainians leaned into what the diaspora Ukrainians had kept alive and were able to share that information. We have to remember that for those 80 years, there was no internet. There was no way that people could access information. Things were guarded and protected and forbidden. So it was like coming out, I think for many Ukrainians, coming out of this experience and then going, where do we find our information? Because either they go back to the 1800s or they look to the diaspora Ukrainians who were able to maintain those practices over that period of time. You know, that is kind of...
Oh, I'm so sorry.
That's okay, go ahead.
That's wild because like every other person we've had has had generally the opposite like way of existence. Like when they're here, they feel like their practice got muddled or changed or just is way different. But the idea that like the diaspora is actually how you return to that origin, so cool and very, very different from what we normally hear here.
It's something very unique and I think very interesting. And I almost say it's like, I mean, definitely those traditions evolved within the diaspora community. I can give one example from the eggs, going back to the eggs. So the traditional Ukrainian way of doing these eggs is keeping the egg whole. And then you let the yolk and the white just dry up. It will dry up eventually. It takes a year or two, right? But it will dry up eventually. The problem is if it breaks before it dries up, it's gonna smell really bad, like a rotten egg, right? So the diaspora Ukrainians started doing a thing where they would blow out the egg white and egg yolk out, put two holes and blow it out before they would dye the eggs to keep it, because this is a talisman that you're gonna keep. It's not something that you eat for Easter or anything like that. But it takes away the essence of the magic of it, because that egg traditionally was a fertile egg that they would use because it had life force. And this sort of diluted practice that sort of happened as in the diaspora has taken away the magic or the concept that the egg has power. Well, it's now just a decorative item, you know.
I mean, it makes sense. You had a life form being protected. It's a protective talisman. That it all checks out there. That actually makes like more sense than blowing out all of that and just holding on to a shell.
Yeah, exactly. So it's not a decorative item, which is what I think it has evolved into, people thinking it's like, oh, it's art, it's cute, it's unique, it's cultural. I mean, there's all these things, but the people that really are attuned to that, the, you know, sort of the magical people know that it's the egg itself that is the magic, and you're harnessing that magic with the designs and so on that you put on it. So I think it's a shared thing. I don't think it's like the diaspora Ukrainians are the heroes coming to the rescue. I do not think that at all. I think it's that the Ukrainians that stayed and the diaspora Ukrainians united together to reform this, make this bridge that could allow a continuity of spiritual magical practice history. So when I wrote the book, I'm like, you know, everybody has a feeling when they write a book that like, oh, are people gonna like it? Are they gonna give me guff or something, you know, about something? And I had a feeling like, oh man, you know, I'm second generation American. Are people going to go like, well, you're not Ukrainian enough, or you're not this enough? But the opposite has happened. Ukrainian people have been so happy and embracing and so supportive of the book because they realize we're all in it together. We saw this at the beginning of the full-scale invasion of Russia, where Zelensky, the president of Ukraine, was saying, diaspora Ukrainians, we need you to be invested in our well-being, and of course the community and the world came forward to support them. But I think Ukrainians understand that people that leave are not leaving because they're like, screw this country. They're leaving under duress, because this is exactly what's happening now with people, and this is what happened to my grandparents, which was they left because it was that or they would get killed. And so if that's the reason that you're leaving, you still have that connection to your homeland. So, yeah.
Yeah. I have learned so much more than I ever thought I ever would have the opportunity. I will never say war is a good thing. I will never ever say that invasion is a amazing opportunity, but just the amount that I have gotten to learn through like watching my mom, who actually was in Switzerland when things started, and she took in a family to try to help out, just the how much we've learned the differences and how much we've learned, like, wow, Ukrainians are these incredible individuals. Because before, when you're American, you don't get a lot of that. Or when you're American and not part of the Slavic diaspora, you don't get a lot of that knowledge about who's who. In fact, all of my parents were going, wow, there were so many times where I really should have asked, is that a Russian individual or is that a Ukrainian individual? And it's just incredible that this situation has actually opened so many different eyes to, like, wow, there was these really powerful differences and we were so ignorant before.
But you're not to be blamed, because understand that the propaganda that was out there was diminishing the uniqueness and wiping out the culture. There is a real, even now today, I won't even say was, there is a real desire on the part of Russia, because they look at Ukrainians, this is the sort of from the top down, as you're the farmers, you're the hillbillies, we're the sophisticates with the culture, but they steal the culture. The fact that they say Kiev in Rus is the Kiev is the center of where Slavic society began. It's in Ukraine. It's not part of Russia. Moscow was a forest at the time that Kiev in Rus was blossoming. So they branched off from the Ukrainians, but it's like these bad children that are resenting their parents, and they have a real inferiority complex, which they then, I think, compensate by saying, well, look at great Russian culture. But they're stealing culture. Yes, there are amazing things that were created in Russia. There's no doubt about that. But they're also stealing things that belong to other people and claiming it as their own, which is not good, you know? So, and even this imperialistic, now, yeah, it's very imperialistic. And they're going in and stealing artifacts from Ukrainian museums during the invasion now. They're going and destroying Ukrainian books in Ukrainian, trying to wipe out the language. It's the same thing if we look at what happened in England with Welsh, Irish, and Scottish. Those languages were attempted, I think, thankfully they're still around, but the attempt was to wipe out those languages. If you spoke Welsh, you could not get a good paying job. You had to speak English. It's the same thing that happened for those 80 years in Soviet rule, where, and before even that, where they were trying to wipe out the language and you must speak Russian. So, you know, this is that situation of what's going on with that. So
with these really powerful feelings and these really immersive experiences that you've gone through, how does that go into the work that you bring to people? I mean, you're well known, especially amongst my friends and I, even before we started in, like, we love your products. I have like 5 different bottles of your stuff around.
You have so much. I know someone who's like, I always buy Madame Pomita's Queen Elizabeth oil, and we stopped carrying it. Like, and they're like, I have to order it. I never buy a different Queen Elizabeth oil. It's just this level of like dedication that your products have.
How that do I you love. Take that powerful emotions and put them into this product? Like, mm-hmm. what influences you to do that? Where do your influences come from for those products?
Well, mostly when I create stuff, I create something that I want to be out in the world, you know, that doesn't exist out in the world. So when I started making candles, which was more than 10 years ago, 15 years ago, I guess 10, 15 years ago, when I was making candles, there was an issue that was going on with candles. The issue that was going on was, number one, you could only get paraffin, mm-hmm. and paraffin is a industrial byproduct, a petroleum byproduct. It's not to say that paraffin is poison, but it doesn't, it releases benzene and toluene when you burn it. And I noticed that I was burning a lot of candles and I was coughing all the time. And I was like, ooh, I wonder what's going on. And I started to see that beeswax was clean burning, healthier. It's a renewable resource. It supports beekeepers who support our bees. It's got a lot of really good things about it. So I wanted to have a beeswax figural candle. And I started out just making the male and female candle. Now we have a human candle. Did you know that? We have male, female, and human. So we have a non-binary candle.
I didn't.
Maybe I did.
I didn't. That's awesome.
Yeah, this is something that came about last year. I've been wanting to do it for a long time. We got a model maker that could make us a model. So we thought, you know, whenever we had to choose between male and female, we had non-binary clients, or we had clients who wanted to do a spell, for example, to attract people in general. Mm-hmm. Which one do you choose, right? You want to attract. Yeah. So we created this human candle that's a non-binary candle. But going back to 10 years ago, I started doing those beeswax candles because A, I wanted beeswax candles, and B, the selection of candles when you would go to the wholesalers was like they'd have like 10 green men and 5 white candle wax women. And I'd be like, what can I do with that? I need the full array of colors. I need to do color magic. So there was a problem with the supply chain back then. Mm-hmm. And also nobody was making beeswax figural candles for magic. Now there's lots of people that are doing it, but that's why I was like, I need this to be out in the world. So that's why I created the candles. Then when I did my books, the same thing happened with my books. I thought, wow, there's really great candle books out there, but they're mostly recipes, like Buckland's book. It's a great book, but it's a recipe book. So it's like, do this, do that, you know, use this color candle, but they're not explaining why. So you're kind of, when you're reading a recipe, it's like being a beginner cook, you're following the recipe, but you're not understanding the concept. So you cannot translate that to looking whatever's in your fridge and making some dinner out of that. Mm-hmm. So my candle book was an attempt to rectify that so that people could create their own spells. I was going to download everything I knew about candle magic, and I've been doing candle magic since I could say since childhood, but doing witchy candle magic since I was in my 20s. Mm-hmm. And so I was like, okay, I'm going to share everything I know about candles, about making candles, magical candles, how all these different techniques. And so it will take you completely from a place of being able to create your own spells. There's a couple recipes in there, but it's really about understanding, how do I bring color magic into this? How do I bring timing into this? And so on. Same thing with Baba Yaga book. When I was like, oh, I really want to find out more about Slavic magic. Mm-hmm. And there wasn't anything out there. There's little bits here and there, but there wasn't really a comprehensive book that was truly about Slavic magic. Mm-hmm. So I wrote a book. So that's what I did. So it's everything.
Make it.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So everything I do, it's like, oh, there's something in the world that I want to be in the world. So I create it because I want it. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's something that other people want too. Sometimes it's like, I make high creativity oil and 5 people buy it. You know what I mean? It's because I want a creativity oil. So,
yeah,
you know, but it's like, you know, so I make things that I want to be out in the world. And that's, I think sometimes people really also want those things to be in the world. And that's a wonderful thing when that happens.
It's this wonderful, terrible idea that there is no creative thought. It's just people who actually finally do it. There's no original thought. So if you have an idea, that means at least a bunch of other people have had the same idea. And if you actually do the thing, other people are going to be like, that's the thing I needed.
Well, there's a thought. This is a book. I don't know if this is a book author thing or if it's an everybody thing, but somebody once told me your muse will ask you to do something. If you don't do it, they're going to pass that idea on to somebody else.
I think that's a book author thing. I had the same thing happen. This is such a good idea. And I'm like, all right, I'm doing it. You don't have to tell me twice. I'm going to do it.
Yeah.
And I always feel as though when books don't like that don't exist in the world, because I wrote Spells for Change because I was like, I need this type of beginner book in the market that's like not specific to one tradition, it's not one specific to one religion, it has a bunch of like a charcuterie board of information that like someone can pick up and be like, oh, I could start in all these places. Because when I was growing up, I was like, all right, Cunningham, this is telling me how to make things, this isn't telling me how to even begin practicing, what I should be thinking about, or how to formulate a practice. So that's why I wrote my book, because yeah. I'm like, so it needs to be here. And I recommend it alongside like a lot of other beginner books that I feel like do similar things or are more specific. I recommend it beside like your book as well, because I think that every beginner should have your book on candle magic. It's just so in depth. I reference it every time I do anything. I'm like, I gotta look at Madame Pamita's book to see what this candle wax means. And I'm like flipping through. It's been so helpful. And because of that, because like of all these reasons, like I keep it, I always carry it with me. It's like got a bunch of post-it notes in it. I love it.
Thank you so much. It's so sweet.
Yeah. I know. Yeah, so I complimenting you after talking. I'm like, hey, I also love your work.
Yeah. So it's like, I mean, it's, I think that, you know, I think some people have a personality that will jump into things and try things and be not, you know, less fearful about failure. I'm like kind of one of those people maybe that it's just like, I'll try it. And I've tried things that have fallen flat. Believe me, I've tried millions of things. I mean, I buy things for the shop in particular. I'm like, oh my God, this is the coolest thing. And nobody's interested. I'm like, okay, whatever. So I think you come up with ideas and you try different things. And then you don't look at failure as a stopping point, but as like, oh, let me try it a different way. Mm-hmm. That's the best thing and way to approach magic too, is if you do a spell and you don't see a result, some people stop there. And I'm like, why are you stopping?
Do it again.
Try something
try
different.
Again.
Yeah. Do it
again.
I call
myself
something different, right?
A fuck around and find out witch, which is really, in my opinion, a lot of folk magic is literally you're just going to try to fuck around with a bunch of different things and you see if it works. So I went, and I didn't used to be a fuck around and find out witch, but I definitely am now, because I'm like, okay, I want to work with the cemetery spirit for the spell. I'm just going to go to the cemetery and walk around. And when I feel like this is the right place to do it, I'm going to grab them. I'm going to get leaf payment. I'm going to leave an offering. I'm going to take them home and we're going to see how it goes. Sometimes it ends up with things falling off the walls and I get them out of the house. And then sometimes I'm like, well, you're pretty nice. Thanks for helping me with this.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's a, like a certain level of like, yeah, I mean, we can look at things. It's great to have someone else. You don't have to reinvent the wheel every time. Yes. Meaning if we look at something like how a certain plant has been used magically or medicinally, we can look at that plant and say, oh, I can try this. But I never say to someone, don't try an off-label, you know, way of doing it. If you want to use roses in a curse, go ahead and try using roses in a curse and see what you end up with. You know, it's not what it's traditionally done with roses, but go ahead and try it. Right?
Rose is that kind of vibe. I'm like, I have such a good relationship with Rose that if I put her in a curse and was like, I need you to mess up someone's love life, she'd probably be like,
sure.
All right. Sure.
Get and those thorns out.
I know Matt mentioned this, but like you do consider yourself an animist. Are there any kind of plants or spirits that you have a really strong relationship with that you would be okay with sharing?
Yeah, I have my, I would say my plant pal, my plant ally, my main plant ally is rosemary, which is a very boring plant.
No, it's not. I love rosemary.
But Matt hates me and rosemary don't get, we don't get along. I don't know why. I think it's because it's so kind. And I'm over here like,
being a bitch.
Yeah, I'm like, excuse me? Like, girl, why are we being nice to everybody? Get it together. We need to do some shit.
Well, I think rosemary is, you know, it's like, to me, rosemary is like a Renaissance plant in the sense of like a Renaissance person, you know, a Renaissance person can do so many things. And if you look at somebody, let's look at the original Renaissance man, which was Leonardo da Vinci. He was a painter. He was an inventor. He was amazing creator. He had a really interesting upbringing and all of his history. I mean, there's so much about an interesting person that, yes, he's a famous person. And if someone says, oh, Leonardo da Vinci is my favorite artist, you're kind of going like, well, do you even know art? Because that's like an obvious answer. So I feel like saying rosemary is like, yeah, that's such an obvious plant or an obvious tool. But I feel like it has so much depth and richness. And to me, that plant really thrives under my care. It also, to me also, I think there's something about if a plant wants to work with you, it will thrive with you. And if it isn't, you know, for whatever reason. And I think for me, rosemary is also, I'm the right kind of person because it thrives under a little bit of neglect, and I'm not a helicopter parent with my plants, so having a plant that sort of takes care of itself and is independent is also a good match for me.
Nice. Yeah. So I love rosemary as like an ancestral plant, like an ally in that way, a plant of remembrance, a plant of protection. I would say that she's not as present in my practice than like rose and rue. Those are the two ones that I'm like, two sides of the same coin, similar to Diana and Mary in my practice. Rose represents this very strong nurture energy that I associate with Mary, and Rue is like, I will kick your ass if you don't take care of yourself. And you're like,
I couldn't grow a Rue plant. My Rue plant died. So Rue, I go, okay.
Really fun. Rue is so, everyone I know who works with Rue is like, watch your ass. She doesn't fuck around. And I'm like, yeah. And I'm trying to get a plant of her this summer, so we'll see. Maybe it'll work, maybe it won't.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I try. I have catnip that I'm working with as well, and I work with catnip. So I tend to sort of, maybe I'm, I don't know. It's just sort of different plants come forward, different plant spirits come forward. But rosemary's my, like, ride or die, you know?
I wish I loved rosemary. It's just that really optimistic person in the office that won't shut up.
That's me.
That's great. I don't think I could work with you for long periods of time then. I could do a few shifts and then I'd be like, okay, we gotta go home. I love you, but I don't want to talk to you for the next like 24 hours. It's just me, man. I know it's me. Just you. I'm aware that I'm the problem in this
situation.
Why are
you like this? And then to kind of finish up, Matt, this is more on your alley, so I'm going to let you guys take it away while I run to the restroom. Talk about folk creatures.
One of my favorite folk questions to ask in any folklore situation, do you have a favorite or any Ukrainian folk creatures that you love to talk about or think about?
There are so many, so many. It for Ukrainians, they, in folk magic, they see every possible space has a different spirit. So you have a spirit of the house, you have a spirit of the barn, you have the spirit of the yard between the house and the barn. You have a spirit of the field, you have a spirit of the forest, you have a spirit of the rivers and lakes. You know, it goes on and on and on. And sometimes multiple spirits. So you have a spirit of the bathhouse, which is like a sauna. You have a spirit, I mean, every space had its own individual spirit who was the master or the mistress of that area. And you would show deference and make offerings to make friends with the space. If that's not animism, I don't even know what is. So, but these beings had physical form. If you saw them, it was the concept was if you could see them many times, let's say, we'll take one, the Domovik. Domovik is the house spirit. He's a little guy who is like, a little guy who's like a gnome. He would, in a Ukrainian home, there would be a big wood stove that was made out of like stucco, a big wood stove, brick and stucco, that would be your cooking, your heating, and took up, you know, people lived in like a little cabin, right? So your room was one room, maybe two rooms, and one quarter of that main room would be this big, massive stove, right? So the Domovik lives behind the stove. He lives in a little nook near the stove. The fire is the spirit of the ancestors, and the Domovik is one of your ancestors who is guarding your home. Aww. A benevolent ancestor who's guarding your home. And so you make offerings to the Domovik so that you don't have problems in your home, things breaking, losing things. If you don't pay attention to your Domovik, you might find that you have things missing because he's like, pay attention to me. So I had the weirdest experience, where I had a safe deposit box key in an envelope in my hand. I walked from my house to my car because I was going to go to that safe deposit box and pull everything out. Mm-hmm. And I got to the car, I looked in the envelope, and the key wasn't in the envelope. It was open.
They just hijacked your key.
And so I'm like, okay, well, it's somewhere in this 20 feet between my car parked at the curb and the entrance to the house. It's somewhere between, I mean, I picked it up in one room and I walked out the house, right? I looked, retraced my steps 50 times, and I could not find that key. It's a brass key, a big brass key. So then somebody said to me, you're not honoring your house spirit. I'm like, you're right. So I started making offerings, and I started making offerings and offerings. And then a few weeks later, I was walking on the grass and I saw the key on the grass. But that key had been there, and I'd walked that space 50 times looking for that key. So the spirit of the house brought the key back when I started paying attention to him. Now I have an altar set up for my Domovik, and I make him offerings every other day.
And ain't nothing going missing.
And nothing's going missing now. So it's so fascinating that the sheer number of the different spirits and the different characteristics of the spirits. We have a situation, which I think it shows up in a lot of folk magic, where the spirit starts to become evil spirits because they're not Christian. If they can't syncretize them into a saint, they're an evil spirit, right? So then we have the idea of Baba Yaga being this evil ogre. She's powerful. She's no bullshit, but you have to understand she's the master of the forest, the mistress of the forest. She's the keeper of the forest, protector of the forest. So she's also the initiator. So she's not there to torture you. She's there to test you. She will test you. So when people are like, oh, I want to be a devotee of Baba Yaga, I'm like, well, be ready because you're going to have to work hard, you know? Mm-hmm. And that's what shows up in these folk tales, which are the way we can carry and remember our stories is through the folk tales that are told. So you find out about these spirits, and then you have to kind of take away the overlays of, you know, patriarchy and patriarchal religions and all of that, that are looking at this old woman as evil and bad. So I think I rectify that in the book, and she's tough, but she's not just pure evil, you know?
I pray for the day that I become an entity of a forest that gets to test people, and that a bunch of old white men are going to be like, that's an evil spirit.
Oh my God.
Well, here's my wish is that we get, by the time that you're in that state, we are done with patriarchy.
For sure. Yeah. Toss it all down. Let's go back to some matriarchy situation. But no, I have told Frankie and all of my friends, when I am old, I'm going to go live on top of a mountain, and I'm going to have people go up the mountain and like work really hard to get up there. And then mm-hmm. I'm going to point to stairs for the way that they can get back down and just be like, yeah, I don't know what y'all are doing.
For that is not an outlandish wish, mm-hmm. because this is the role of the teacher. And when you get to be an elder and you have lots of experience, hopefully we are in a time and place where people are looking to the elder people and saying, yeah, I want to learn from you because you have these decades of experience. Mm-hmm. And you can initiate them in some way. I don't think it's like an initiation, like, oh, I'm going to initiate you to be a, you know, a third degree Mason or whatever. It's not like that, but it's like an initiation of being, are you ready? Are you ready for whatever's to come, you know?
Yeah. I was going to say, I just read a book called The Bear and the Nightingale, which has a lot of, it's a fiction book, Ukrainian folklore spirits. And it's like a priest comes to the village and makes it so they have to stop worshiping their local spirits, and basically all hell breaks loose. And there's one girl going around giving like the spirits a bunch of offerings from what like they have. And I feel like you would really like it. It's like a series, but I read this and I'm like, this is so good because it's literally like, and I do think it probably blends some level of like Russian folklore and Ukrainian folklore to an extent, because there are some that like, I'm like, that's Ukrainian. I'm like, I don't know about that one. Maybe. But I'm also not as knowledgeable as you in that area, so they may all be Ukrainian.
Yeah.
But yeah, I feel like you would enjoy that.
And then, of course, final thoughts.
Yeah, final thoughts. Part. Anything else you want to add?
Well, I would say, you know, for people that are curious about looking into Slavic magic, I really see it as an open practice. I really think about like how people approach things, you know, in any practice. Are you coming respectfully? Are you coming being respectful of the culture? Mm-hmm. Are you coming, you know, I think that's the sort of the dividing line. If you're going to come and take something and say, this is mine, that's not respectful. Are you going to come into someone's house and take something off the shelf and say, oh, well, I'm taking this and I'm going to say it's mine? Or are you coming and saying, this is belongs to this culture, but I want to practice this? That's very different. Mm-hmm. That's a different vibe for sure. You know, it's like anything. Are you supporting the culture, or are you just taking from the culture? Are you trying to create safe spaces, right? That's mm-hmm. a huge thing. We talk about indigenous, BIPOC people, and women, are we creating, and trans, LGBTQ trans people, all this, are we creating safe spaces, or are we just taking that and saying it's mine? So, you know, anybody can come and practice Slavic magic. I'm so happy when I see people adapt these things and then they say, this is a Ukrainian practice. That's great. Don't have to be Ukrainian to practice Ukrainian magic, but you have to acknowledge it's Ukrainian magic, right? So, yeah. I don't know. Is that a closing thought?
That's a closing thought. Amazing. I would say, if people want to find you outside of this podcast, where should they look?
My website is Parlor of Wonders, spelled P-A-R-L-O-U-R, mm-hmm. Parlor of Wonders. That's my headquarters for me, my products, my free live Q&A. That's another thing. If I have a free live Q&A every Sunday, except for the first Sunday of the month. Mm-hmm. And we do a like a podcast recording, and then we do answer questions. And if someone wants to join in on that, they just go to spellsquad.com. They can join the Spell Squad and they can come and join me. And if you have questions about magic, you're curious about something, which candle should I use for this kind of spell, or you know, how should I use this herb or whatever, come and ask those questions and I'd be so happy to answer it.
Nice. Yeah. Matt, final thoughts? Anything?
We have to have Madam Pumita on more often.
Yeah. That's my final thought. Just to talk about a bunch of different things.
I love you guys so much. This has been such a pleasure to sit and talk with you, you know, really to talk about something that I love. And we don't get to talk about folk magic enough. I never get enough of it, mm-hmm. you know? So when I get somebody that I get to talk to and share with, I'm so happy.
Folk magic is our favorite topic. At least it's my favorite topic. That's
the whole thing
we do. Yeah. And we're like, folk magic? This has been Books and Broomsticks. I'm Chaotic Witchaunt.
And I'm Matt Hatterplace.
And I'm Madam Pamita.
And we'll talk to you guys next week.